All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Tracy Smith, Judge Jessen, Judge Brian, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome, everybody, and us to Duluth, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have three cases on our oral calendar this morning. Today is May 11th, 2023. Our first case is A22-1038, David M. Smith et al. Respondents versus Temple Corp. Incorporated et al. Appellants. Counsel, it looks like you will both be arguing from the center podium. We have our clock there. And I think we can all see what's happening with the clock, so that's good. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. When you start your arguments, please state your name and a party you represent for the record. I believe we are live streaming this right now, but we're keeping only an audio version, which will be on our website publicly available sometime later today or tomorrow. So, appellants, counsel, if you're ready to go, we're ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Miles Ringsred, and I represent appellants in this appeal. This matter concerns the St. Regis Apartments, a building located less than a mile from this courtroom, made up of 18 two-bedroom units. In March of 2020, Governor Waltz issued an executive order placing a moratorium on evictions due to the COVID-19 pandemic. In response to this, a majority of the St. Regis tenants, including respondents, stopped paying rent in March of 2020. By late fall, the rental arrearages amounted to over $40,000. In October, the appellants were alerted that the building heat system had stopped working. There was a problem with one of the so-called state-of-the-art electronic control systems, which several contractors were unable to fix. A number of tenants, after consulting, appellants found a way around to manually operate the system, but this was unacceptable to the City of Duluth building officials, and the city shut off the gas to the building and issued a condemnation order due to the lack of heat and habitability on November 16th, 2020. A number of tenants consulted Legal Aid of Minnesota, who brought this action on their behalfs on October 23rd, 2020, under a section of the Landlord-Tenant Statutes, Minnesota Statute 504B.381, entitled Emergency Tenants Remedy Action, or ETRA. On November 18th, 2020, the Housing Court ordered appellants either fix the problem or find alternative housing for the tenants, and also ordered rent be placed in escrow with the court. Appellants counterclaimed that the nonpayment of tenants were legally prohibited from the ETRA action due to their breach of these leases by not paying rent for at least 6 months. The counterclaim, which is the main subject of the appeal, was denied on January 20th, 2021. Appellants compiled with the court's order by housing these tenants in motels and hotels until the heat was finally restored and the city's condemnation order was lifted in February of 2021.
Counsel, if I may.
Yep.
Just because I think we're pretty familiar with the facts, but I want to just jump to what I understand is the issue, which is basically you're saying, look, they materially breached their lease by not paying it. And that was what led to this. And framing that in terms of, I'm looking at the Emergency Tenant Remedies Action, Subdivision 6, that limitation.
Yes.
It's fair to say that's the thrust of your argument?
That is one aspect of it, at least to the respect that according to that part of the statute that you pointed out, yes, a breaching party or someone who materially contributes to the emergency that has arisen prohibits them from bringing that. And so that is one of our claims.
So the district court denied your motion to dismiss or summary judgment on that. And so it goes to trial, right?
Correct.
And I'm just trying to understand what happened at trial. I don't think we have a transcript. And looking at did the district courts then, you know, implicitly deny that? You know, I'm just following this through the track. Where is the best place to look about what the district court decided as far as your argument that the limitation subdivision 6 does not apply?
You can look at both the order denying our appellant's motion to dismiss the action, and you can also look in the final order as well. Because this boils down to both the final order, which awarded damages, and then the first order denying the motion to dismiss, which really deals with this first issue that you're bringing up about whether a breaching party can bring a defense such as this. And so, as we cited in our briefs, you can start with contract law.
But before we get to there, I want to make sure I'm clear in your answer to this question. So, if the district court denies a motion to dismiss saying that is not a defense, that doesn't exist in the law, you can't raise that defense, and then you go to trial, you're really appealing just that initial decision on, we'll call it a motion to dismiss, right?
Yes. So the first aspect of this, there are two parts. So we're saying this motion to dismiss, basically saying the breaching parties shouldn't be able to maintain an action under this. But then the other part we appealed was the final order in which they awarded damages. We're saying that they did not have sufficient evidence to.
Right. No, I understand that. I just want to focus one more time, if we can, on the what you've been calling a motion to dismiss, because I don't know that that's how the district court treated it and how the district court denied it. So in your view, what's the best way to characterize that in light of the statement from the district court that this is better handled as a motion for summary judgment?
Well, with respect to a motion for summary judgment, what it at least our motion to dismiss, that gets us a little bit further down in the realm of the covenants of habitability versus covenants to pay rent. We cited extensively to Fritz v. Worthen.
Right. So are you saying that there's multiple parts of the argument that was in what you're calling the motion to dismiss? One seems like a pure legal issue. Is there a defense as a matter of law? And then there's another one that you're about to talk about, given the covenants, this sort of common law application of these covenants.
Well, this is actually statutory law as well.
So. Fine. It's both. It's codified, yes. Right? So
yep.
Just as to that first part, I'm trying to figure out how to characterize the motion that was made below, given that the district court said this is really a summary judgment motion. Are you saying that the district court only did that with respect to the balancing of the covenants that tenants and landlords have?
I don't think he necessarily said this was a matter for summary judgment, because what we were basically saying, because a lot of the issues brought up in the Fritz case were codified into statute. And so if you follow that, the district court ordered pursuant to 504B.385, rent escrow action to remedy violations. As long as the proceedings are pending under this section, the residential tenants must pay rent to the landlord or direct to the court and may not withhold rent to remedy the violation. The statute providing for payment of rent in escrow and also for landlord's counterclaim of possession if tenants fail to comply. So that gets you down to a subdivision 2 of this section, where it says counterclaim for possession. The landlord may file a counterclaim for possession of the property in cases where the landlord alleges that the residential tenants did not deposit the full amount of rent with the court administrator. And at that point, it had been several months in which the residential tenants were ordered by the court to place rent into escrow, and bar one occasion where a small portion of rent was put in, not a single respondent complied with this. And so that was the thrust of the motion to dismiss. We were acting under the counterclaim for possession. And
can I just ask one, hopefully, for me, last question on the procedural part of it? Does it matter whether it's summary? I'm trying to figure out why it matters. But you have legal issues, and then you have issues that the damages awards are not supported by the record. Is that right? Do we need to worry? Why does it matter to you whether it's motion to dismiss, summary judgment, or just a legal issue on appeal related to this?
Well, I think that distinction, whether it's summary judgment or at the stage that we brought it, it doesn't really matter, because at the same, whether it's summary judgment or a dismissal, essentially on the pleadings, it's still undisputed facts. It was an undisputed fact that tenants had failed to comply with the court order and put rent into escrow as ordered by the court. Does that answer your question?
I think so. I think so.
Okay.
So just following up on that. So when the district court in its order denying your motion to dismiss in paragraph 2 says that these claims create genuine issues of material fact on, and then goes to list the subdivision 6, basically, you know, whether they, this was a result of deliberate or negligent act. You disagree with that?
No. So that is correct. That would be a correct statement. So we were making allegations that under that provision that the tenants materially contributed to the emergency.
So you agree under that provision,
yes,
there were material issues of fact. Those went to trial, and that gets to my, okay, where do we look to most specifically see what, how the district,
yes,
court resolved them?
Yep. And so then, and however, not a single, so, and then ultimately with respect to the counterclaim for possession, he denied that in the very final paragraph where he stated, otherwise put, defendants cannot do as defendants constructively convict by having the court dismiss this ETRA action what they would be unable to do as plaintiffs, evict based on non-payment of rent under the emergency order. So that is the part of the order denying our counterclaim for possession. And the problem with this is the district court conflated dismissing the emergency tenant remedies action with an eviction. This is exactly the same error this court held that a district court made in a case called State v. Ellison, or State by Ellison v. Mostad. And I'd like to note that this case is not recorded and recorded as non-precedential, but appellants asked this court to recognize its own reasoning. In State by Ellison v. Mostad, the Minnesota Court of Appeals applied statutory construction principles to emergency executive order and held that the emergency executive order is narrowly stated to suspend the ability to file an eviction action under Minnesota statutes. In other words, this executive order only prevented appellants from initiating an eviction action. It did not suspend basic contract principles. It did not restrict district court from dismissing the ETRA. It did not require the district court reject appellant's counterclaim for possession, nor any other legal remedies available that were not specifically stated in that executive order. And that is exactly what the district court did to deny our motion for or our counterclaim for possession.
And the counterclaim for, stepping back for a second, even if they were not even an emergency order, the counterclaim for possession you're arguing is available under 0.381.
Yes.
The Emergency Tenant Remedies Act.
Yes, subdivision, right? 2, and I believe.
Under 0.381, subdivision which?
Oh, 504B.385.
Right. You're in 385. I'm in 381 because this is an Emergency Tenant Remedies Act, right? And you say your argument is, oh, if I'm understanding it, it's also a rent escrow action under 0.385. That's where I'm having some confusion, because 385 is where it says that there's a counterclaim.
Sure. Okay. And so what these were at least brought up essentially along with Fritz, because Fritz dealing with an emergency tenant remedies action and this and similar, this was eventually codified in something like this. And the district court did order them to pay rent into escrow because of the similarities. They're both under the tenant remedies section of landlord-tenant statutes.
Is there any previous case where we have allowed the counterclaim contemplated by that part of the statute dealing with rent escrow actions in an emergency tenant remedies action?
No, but I would have this court apply statutory canons of interpretation as this is under the same tenants remedies action provision of this statute.
Right, but we have a subdivision that is specific to the emergency, the ETRA, mm-hmm, that says limitation, and that does give a defense, so sort of what you're thinking of is like contributory negligence, if you will, right?
Sure.
There's lots of statutory principles, lots of statutory canons, including looking at that and deducing from that, that if the legislature had wanted to also say the same thing they had just said on the rent escrow action, they could have in subdivision six, but they didn't.
Sure. But also the district court, by applying this and requiring this, also saw the rationale and the reasoning behind requiring something like this. Again, if you look at the Fritz case, what they anticipated, if a tenant was able to stop paying rent to a landlord for a breach of their covenant of habitability, this exact same situation would continue to exacerbate the problem. If a building, and I'll quote from Fritz, in a building where all or a substantial number of tenants withhold their rent, this could be devastating to a landlord because he is deprived of the rental income. He may be unable to correct the very conditions that the tenants contends renders the premises uninhabitable.
So if I may, and this is probably too high a level of summary, but you're asking this court, as I understand it, to issue a precedential opinion to state that there should be that a counterclaim for possession should be available under the Emergency Tenant Remedies Action. Is that fair to say?
Yes. I see I only have 10 seconds left, so unless there are any other questions, I'll take a seat and reserve the rest of my argument for rebuttal.
All right, we'll see you on rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, my name is Jude Schmidt, attorney for respondents. May it please the court. Appellants, this appeal is centering on appellants are attempting to expand the scope of an ETRA by adding preconditions. In this case, the precondition, the only precondition in the statute is that my clients, respondents, provided 24-hour notice to the appellants that they would bring a ETRA if the boiler wasn't fixed. There is no dispute on the record that that did not occur. There is no dispute as to the form of the complaint. It was verified. It stated adequately the nature of the emergency and the relief sought under 504B.425. However, now they're attempting to add this precondition that basically under a first breach theory that since my clients allegedly, and mind you, we dispute that there was ever a breach, we dispute the allegation of arrears. And
well, I'm going to jump in here because I think it's not so much expanding. I mean, you could see under subdivision six, a situation where if the facts showed this, that somebody could say, the action of the tenant is responsible for the emergency or was they were negligent and that caused the emergency. And that's an existing precondition, if to use your words, in the statute, that if the facts were to establish such a thing would be there. And their argument is that the non-payment of rent is the thing on that point that causes the emergency. So at least theoretically, it seems like that is part of what's already in the statute. The other aspect of, you know, can a tenant breach the lease by non-payment? And does that relieve the duty that the landlord has or, you know, grafting on something from rent escrow? That's separate than
sure.
Does this fit subdivision six or not?
Fair enough. And what I would submit is that the subdivision six, the negligence, what is alleged here is negligent breach of contract, which Minnesota law does not recognize. However, and I think what the statute contemplates when it comes to negligence, for instance, would be a scenario where, a tenant leaves a door open in the dead of winter, pipes freeze, that's the causes destruction. That might be the basis for a defense under the ETRA statute. I don't think it contemplates a negligence in terms of these aggregate arrears contributing to the fact that appellants couldn't make the fix. And again, we dispute that the level of arrears were as high as they say.
Can I ask another follow-up? Do you make a distinction? I think in the brief that appellants have submitted, they're focused on that language and then make the next logical step, which is that therefore there's this implied duty of good faith and fair dealing that was breached through non-payment do you make a distinction between an action that might be negligent and an action that would constitute a violation of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing? In other words, is bad faith different or more than regular negligence?
Well, see, can you repeat that one more time? I have to think through this. I didn't really contemplate the bad faith component because the thing, if I may, Your Honor, this is a summary proceeding with very narrow, it's a very narrow remedy, and it's to address the emergency. These allegations regarding the aggregate arrears was never proven. In fact, the record they cite to was struck for failing to comply, I believe, with confidentiality. We don't have, it's just not part of the record of litigation. And we never even got into these were just bald-faced allegations that my clients didn't pay. They've been vilified from the get-go. And this is just a diversion. This whole appeal, the whole process has been.
Counsel, if I may. Okay, so for purposes of this question, let's assume I agree with you. This is just a narrow summary proceeding under the Emergency Tenant Remedies Act. Okay. But there is this Subdivision 6 limitation. And the district court, or the referee, the district court basically said, look, there are issues of material disputed fact as to whether the tenant's actions rise to the level of being that deliberate or negligent act, you know, causing this. Right? So the district court, right? You would agree with me there. Yeah. So my question is, where do we look to see how the district court resolved that after trial? Do we have to just say it was an implicit decision? Because I'm just looking at the findings, conclusions, and order for judgment, which really go to a lot of the damages issues. So help me with that, if you would. Because I just want to be able to look and say, okay, if we agree with you and that we're framing in this narrow summary proceeding, there was this issue teed up. What happened?
So, Your Honor, that these issues were addressed at trial, and I would submit the Subdivision 6 was not brought up at trial. We don't have a transcript here today to review this, and you know that the burden is
on. So we shouldn't even be able to reach it because there's not a transcript?
I would argue, yes. As to the defense and as to the breach, the damages issue. The damages issue, eight tenants testified over a full day trial discussing the concept, you know, the how their tenancy was impacted by being displaced from December to April while the boiler is being replaced. And they discussed issues of the costs when it came to the having to eat out, living out of a hotel, the extra gas. Various costs, laundry. And we submitted documentation on the record, and that was in the that would have been in the transcript had it been submitted. But since it wasn't submitted, it's difficult for this court to determine whether there was an abuse of discretion. So,
can I ask a question? The legal question of whether there is a counterclaim available for possession under the emergency. The ETRA, oh, right? Okay. Right. So let's take a world where there's no, you know, eviction moratorium or anything, just like normal world. And in fact, tenants have not been paying. And then there's an emergency. Okay. And the landlord, who would have grounds to evict if they went forward with an eviction action, presumably, presume that for purposes of my question. That's important to them to cut off, I suppose, whatever future damages of housing someone elsewhere. And else, what would be the normal process in order for a landlord to be able to cut off the expenses, if not by a counterclaim under the ETRA? Do they have to do something different, bring in eviction? Like what? You sure. Understand my question?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, Your Honor. I think, well, what would happen in post or pre-moratorium is landlords would have the ability to file an eviction. And under the rent escrow statute, if in fact this was filed under the rent escrow statute, counterclaim for possession would be achieved by what would require a separate complaint and service. That didn't occur here either. So even if you were to expand the ETRA to include that counterclaim, I don't think the statute contemplates.
So your first position would be the ETRA just simply doesn't contemplate a counterclaim for possession as a defense.
Exactly.
And what would happen in a non-moratorium world is that you have the landlord has to bring an eviction action.
Separate action.
And here the landlord could not because of the moratorium. Could not. Time. Okay. Secondly, you're saying even if one converted and looked at this as a rent escrow action, which you argue it is not, in any event, the requirements for bringing a counterclaim were not satisfied here. Correct. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. How does it figure in, if at all, to the analysis, sort of like thinking what the moratorium means to this? I mean, a moratorium then would also, is the argument preclude, it precludes an eviction, but it doesn't give you the effective, how does that factor into trying to cut off, you know what I mean?
Fair question. Well, that is the rub here. The fact is the landlords, the appellants, were unable to bring an eviction for non-payment. Their other recourse could have been to file, and the district court mentioned this, they were not precluded from filing a conciliation claim to recoup damages. Also, under the tenant remedies statute, they could have requested an administrator be appointed to collect rents. That was never requested.
And the idea, I suppose, the moratorium is you may not evict during this time, and so you need to provide a heated apartment or the equivalent.
And you know, even if, let's say they could file an eviction, let's say there's an eviction pending, no emergency has yet occurred. But during the pendency of an eviction, you know, there's that week from that first appearance, week later you have trial. An emergency arises, appellants would still be liable to fix that emergency. That the covenants of habitability are not waived because of material breaches.
So what's the end date of the damages here? And what is the district court saying about sort of future actions relative, I guess, to like financial obligations among the parties? The district court said, no, you can't. It's not a defense here, but, you know. What was the end date of the?
When they returned to the apartments, which was around April.
Okay.
It was about a 4 to 5 month period. The tenants were in hotels, going between hotels. It was a trying time. So that was the window for damages. And we actually did not get to the damages until, I believe, a year later from when they moved in. I think it would have been May of 22. So, and, you know, I have to emphasize too, because appellants say that they were $40,000 in arrears, but at the end of the day, my clients paid appellants nearly $87,000 in rent.
Well, is there going to be a way in which, if there's an allegation of unpaid rent, is that resolvable in the future?
It is now, yes. In fact, there, as counsel appellants referenced in their correspondence at the start of this case, there were evictions that have long passed. I believe there's only one more tenant left at the St. Regis Apartments.
So, counsel, I think we can all agree, for all concerned, that this was a trying time. There's absolutely, that seems clear to me, at least to me, speaking only for myself, clear. But when you're talking about kind of the need to really, let's just focus on the Emergency Tenant Remedies Act, and it's narrow, it's summary. But then how do you reconcile with the fact that with the district court here ordering the tenants to pay rent in escrow under Minnesota Statute 504B, 385. I mean, doesn't that muddy the waters?
It's sure, yes, but it was, I don't know.
Well, then what do we do with that?
Well, he filed, the escrow order was under 425.425, and emergency tenant remedy actions don't require escrow as they do in rent escrow. If you don't need, like in a rent escrow action, you need to start a case. If there's rent owed, you have to pay the rent, not in emergency tenant remedies. And I would say that the district court order, yes, the referee ordered escrow, but he also conditioned it on if they don't pay because of the moratorium, that this would be considered when awarding consequential damages and abatement. So that was accounted for. There was no order conditioning the continuation of the ETRA on monthly payments of rent.
And was the escrow just until the administrator was appointed, I think, under the order?
There was no administrator appointed.
But did it say until? My recollection was, as it said, until there's a... I mean, the 425 authorizes the appointment of an administrator to collect rents, et cetera, right?
It does.
And my recollection of the order, I might be wrong, is that it was escrow until an administrator is appointed, but maybe not.
Your Honor, it may have been early on. There were so many orders and they were modified, but I think in the end, at the latest order is that rent was to be escrowed. If not, it would be taken, equity would be taken into account on the damages issue at the final trial.
But your argument is ordering escrow doesn't convert it into an escrow action.
Exactly.
0.385. Okay.
Can I ask a similar question if I may?
Sure.
On the statutory language around this. So, in 504B395, one of the subdivisions, it says when an action may be brought, it says an action may not be brought under, and then it lists several statutes, including both the rent escrow statute and our ETRA. So in this is the provision where you're saying the district court used this statutory provision, 0.395, to order escrow or rent paid in escrow. My question is similar to what you've been asked before about whether it muddies the waters. The fact that these are all listed together in subdivision 3 about when an action may be brought, both the rent escrow action and ETRA are listed in the same sentence. Does that muddy the waters as far as whether or not there's a counterclaim for possession available in this kind of action?
Well, real quick, I think yes, they're in the same subsection under 504B, but they're very different purposes. A rent escrow, again, is for non-emergency repairs. It's conditioned on paying rent. In fact, there's a two-week notice in there, which again suggests that it's for non-emergency. And, you know, let's face it, emergency ETRAs often involve condemnations. People are displaced. I imagine the intent of the legislature was to not necessarily require escrow. Yes, that's all. That answers your question.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just to respect to this last question, as I suggested earlier as well, that yes, that is very suggestive of the fact that you should interpret these similar tenant remedies sections should be interpreted together, as they are extremely similar. And even though this emergency tenant remedies action section does not have the possession or that provision, we can really look to again to Fritz. In Fritz, they held that the covenant to pay rent and the covenant of habitability, we hold that these implied covenants of habitability and a covenant for payment of rent are mutually dependent rather than independent. This means a covenant in a lease for payment of rent and the covenants of habitability and residential.
But doesn't all that mean is that if someone doesn't pay rent, then the landlord, instead of just saying, we're going to turn off the heat, the landlord needs to commence an eviction action or an unlawful detainer action at the time, if I'm remembering my timing right. So it's not saying that the duty of habitability no longer applies or that there is some defense based on who breached first. All it's saying is there is a remedy that the landlord has to bring an eviction action for non-payment of rent.
That is actually not quite true. Under Fritz, and I'll quote, because of the mutuality of the statutory covenants of habitability and the covenant to pay rent, the tenant may now assert breach of statutory covenants in excuse, justification, or avoidance of the landlord's action. So reversed, this was a case where a landlord tried to, in Fritz, tried to evict a tenant, but then they counterclaimed saying that there were all these breaches of habitability. So in this case, and the same defense that applied in that case, because they were able to say that is a defense, their prior breach of habitability essentially was a defense to the landlord's eviction action. So that statement is not quite on point. And so
is there a case applying Fritz in the reverse, as you're kind of alluding to for us?
I'm not aware.
Okay.
Did you want to finish?
No,
was there
ahead.
More to say on that? So if we were in a world where there was no emergency, okay, and we get to October and you're saying that there was a non-payment of rent, but there's a moratorium, the landlord would have continued to have to house the tenants in the building, right? Through the moratorium. They were unable to evict, right?
Yes.
So they had to provide there, even though the tenants were not paying the rent, allegedly, right?
Yes.
And so why shouldn't they have to, if they had to do that during the moratorium, why shouldn't the landlord likewise have to provide them, if that's lacking heat, a substitute? I mean, why doesn't that make logical sense?
Can you rephrase that question?
Why, if the tenant would have to continue to house them until some end point, right? Why wouldn't they have to put them up in a place with heat if their apartments actually lacked heat? Why doesn't that make logical sense?
Because again, that gets us back to the Mostad case, where reading that emergency executive order, as this court interpreted it very narrowly, to only suspend the ability to file evictions. In that case, it went on, and it was a pretty egregious case where the landlord went in and basically pulled apart the circuit breaker so that they didn't have electricity. And in that case, this court literally ruled that this executive order does not prevent constructive evictions or any other actions. It literally just stops a landlord from terminating the contract or bringing an eviction action under these statutes. And I'd like to quickly touch on a couple of the other aspects when it comes to the award of damages. And they talked about the arrears not being on the record. And that was because respondents and the district court argued they wanted to basically cap this off. It was a pretty messy situation. There were a lot of plaintiffs at that point involved in this, and they didn't want to look that far back. That was respondents' position brought, and that is why these issues were not necessarily brought on the record. We introduced this onto the record. It was definitely on there, but it was, the court didn't want to get bogged down in that aspect of this. I see my time is up, but
you can wrap up. We gave some extra time. So if you have another wrap up thing.
Yeah, and so I think I would just want to say some of these statutory, the question with respect to appellant's second argument with respect to awarding damages can also be broken down to also, does the tenant have the, are they entitled to an award of damages while they are also the breaching party in this action? And so this argument doesn't bog us down in some of these complicated issues relating to the covenants of habitability in some of these statutes, but just to contract principles of whether a breaching party is able to maintain an award of damages at the end of the day. So if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. If not,
thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thank you.